What they say, they do not do. They aren't willing to lift a finger. All their works, they do to be noticed by men. Hypocrites, sons of hell, blind guides, fools and blind ones, whitewashed tombs, full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Snakes, brood of vipers, your house is left to you desolate. Now, these are some of the most damning words in the Bible against anyone. And they come out of the mouth of our meek and humble Messiah towards the Pharisees and scribes. People either grab hold of them as an excuse for their own daily behavior, or they just try to ignore the whole chapter. But let's look at it head on. Exactly what was polemic in the Hellenistic world, and why aren't we generally reading this in the spirit in which it was offered? Either being way too harsh or being way too excusing. What, in short, was our Savior trying to communicate 2 days before the Passover and his death? And how did it differ from his behavior before all this? And why? Hi, I'm Tyler Don Rosenquist, and welcome to Character in Context, where we explore the historical context of Scripture and talk about how it bears on our own behavior and our witness as image bearers. You can find my teachings on my websites, theancientbridge.com and contextforkids.com, as well as on my YouTube channels, which are accessible from my websites. You can access past broadcasts on my podcast channel, characterincontext.podbean.com, and my context books for adults and families are available through amazon.com. So, those were some harsh words. And they stand in stark contrast with the Beatitudes and the fruit of the Spirit. They were insulting, accusatory, and inciting trouble. Yeshua, or you might know him as Jesus, came to Jerusalem for the express purpose of having a showdown with the Jerusalem elites who'd been testing him and trying to trap him throughout his Galilean ministry in the north. Indeed, the Synoptic Gospels never even show Yeshua in Jerusalem until that fateful Passover, and it is only John who records any other trips up to Jerusalem for feast times. This is because the Synoptics are building a narrative that shows a progression from Yeshua being a relative nobody from nowhere, and then preaching and working miracles and growing in popularity in the north, attracting enough attention that elites from Jerusalem are dispatched to go and test him, and finally, riding into Jerusalem in triumph, surrounded by Galilean pilgrims, much to the disgust and worry of the Jerusalem leadership. Now, before this time, in the Gospel of Matthew, where we will be focusing, it's notable that Yeshua is not the one picking fights. He just finishes them. But now, for the past couple of chapters, he has been on the offensive, outright provoking the elites. Now, why? Well, one, because they've finally just gone too far. They have not accepted him. And so, because of this, it is time for Yeshua to die. Before now, he has wisely picked his fights carefully, even evading confrontation or altogether escaping it. But he's come to Jerusalem for a purpose, and that purpose is to die for the sins of the world, to defeat death and sin, and to launch the greater second exodus spoken of by the prophets, where the entire world, and not just Israel, is freed from slavery to sin, death, and false gods. Now, we'll talk about that more in the future when we get to the Gospel of Mark. And this isn't to be confused with what Scripture calls the gathering, which is when the saved, when Israel from all over the world is returned to the Holy Land. That's a completely different concept. That's the gathering, and that's when they talk about people from all over the world will come to Jerusalem for the feast, that sort of thing. They'll be gathered from the four winds and that sort of thing. I didn't really mean the part about everybody from all over the world coming to the feast. That's something entirely different. Evidently, my post-nasal drip has gone to my brains. Anyway, so pretty harsh language, those insults that I started out the program with. Pretty shocking from our sweet, humble, and meek Messiah. But would it have been shocking in those days? Not like it shocks us. No. Today we're going to talk about the very entertaining subject of polemic in the ancient world, or maybe better described as Hellenistic insults. Now, it sometimes shocks people to think of first century Jews as Hellenistic. I mean, a lot of people use the phrase Greek thinking as though it's an insult, not knowing that Jewish thought in the first century and beyond was entirely permeated by Greek thought. In fact, we really have no clue as to what genuine Jewish thought without the Greek influences even looked like. Synagogues were a product of Hellenism. Rabbis and disciples, Greek. The emergence of Torah becoming seen as law codes over wisdom literature, Greek. The focus on Torah reading, study, and memorization, Greek. The whole idea of making grand tombs of the prophets and the martyrs, Greek. You know, not everything Greek is pagan or bad. It's just like, if you look at another country and you like the way they run their government, you don't say, well, who do they worship? You say, well, does that work administratively? I mean, the synagogues were a good idea, right? Studying the Torah, teaching it to the children, memorizing it, and not just hearing it once every 7 years, as the Torah, you know, puts out there as the bare minimum, that's good. It's good. We should study Scripture. We should fill ourselves with Scripture. But that was a Greek idea. It's not something you see in the Torah and in the Old Testament. Now, polemic, or what we see in Matthew 23 in the woes, which is where I got all those insults, is classically Greek. We see it throughout the time period in the writings of Jews and Gentiles, from the New Testament to Josephus and against Appian and Philo's The Embassy to Gaius, to the writings of the Cynics, Stoics, and Epicurean philosophers. In short, in the ancient world where differences in philosophies clashed, wherever they clashed, polemic was sure to be part of it. Don't look at them to be acting like gentlemen as we would consider it. Remember, Yeshua changed the world. He did. He changed the way we dialogue with each other. He changed how people interact with each other. Now, as part of my studies into Matthew 23, I happened across a reference to an excellent article by Luke T. Johnson, professor of New Testament and Christian Origins at the Candler School of Theology. It's called, this is a long one even by my standards, The New Testament's Anti-Jewish Slander and the Conventions of Ancient Polemic. And it's available through jstor.org. This article is great because it didn't delve into any theology, made no excuses, and didn't even address the charges against the scribes and the Pharisees. All it did was talk about the literary form of polemic during those times. If you enjoy reading about philosophers tearing each other apart with insults, then this will be a highly enjoyable read for you. Now, as far as the specific charges against the scribes and the Pharisees, we'll be covering that in future episodes. That's not what this one's about. This one's going to talk about the overall tenor and the way it was speaking and why it was phrased the way it was and what was Yeshua trying to accomplish. What did he accomplish? Now, before anyone objects to the term philosophy, because I know it's a loaded term these days, but it's another term that's been changed. It's like if we talk in the late 19th century about being gay, well, you're happy. If you talk about it now, you're homosexual. Words change meaning, and we have to take into context what the word meant during the time. So, I don't want you to think about modern college philosophy professors and programs. I don't want you to think about metaphysics. I want you to think about moral systems. In the Hellenistic first century, the philosophical life was about leaving vice behind and pursuing virtue, regardless of religious sensibilities. As Johnson states, it was the quest for health by those who were morally ill. That being said, no one could agree on how to do that, and so whatever group you were with, the other groups had to be classified as dangerous and even depraved. Josephus described the different sects of Judaism as competing philosophies, Essenes, Sadducees, Pharisees, which were further broken down into the Hillelites and Shammites. I don't know if Shammites are, I might have just made up a word. That's how he saw it from within Judaism, as a member of the priestly case within Judaism, who self-reported that he tried out each one to decide which he liked best and ended up becoming a Pharisee. All right. You know, we would call them denominations today. All right. But an example of some of the rhetoric against the Sophists, which was a branch of, you know, it was a philosophical school. Well, I'm not going to get into that. It's by Dio of Prusa, and he lived from 40 to 120 of the Common Era. Ignorant, boastful, self-deceived, unlearned, and deceiving by their words, evil-spirited, impious, liars and deceivers, preaching for the sake of gain and glory and only their own benefit. They are flatterers, charlatans, and sophists. They profit nothing. They are mindless, boastful, and shameless, deceiving others and themselves. Demagogues. Now, Aelius Aristides, who lived from 117 to 181 of the Common Era, he was a sophist, and he had some choice words about philosophers. They despise others while being themselves worthy of scorn. They criticize others without examining themselves. They make a great show of virtue and never practice it. He says that they have the outward appearance of virtue, but are inwardly corrupt. They are only after pleasure and wealth. They are flatterers, in contrast to the sophist, which for him is a good word, unlike Dio of Prusa. They have thought of our spoken discourses, or they have never thought of or spoken discourses profitable to their contemporaries, never praised the brilliance of feasts, never honored the gods, never counseled cities, never consoled the afflicted, never worked for peace, never addressed exhortations to the young or those who have been banned, never observed the conventions in their language. Now, this is important. Johnson points this out. Polemic has nothing. Remember, polemic means Hellenistic insults. It's a form of debate and literary ridicule against one's philosophical enemies. Polemic has nothing to do with specific actions. This is Johnson pointing this out, but typical ones. Any teacher of whom you disapprove can be called a sophist or a charlatan. That is to say, this was largely rhetoric that was scripted and only modified slightly to suit one's opponent. I have pointed out in other teachings that in the ancient world, stereotypes were shamelessly employed by everyone, by our sensibilities, which they did not share. When I'm talking about shamelessly, Paul said all Cretans are liars. And Yeshua is certainly going to use stereotypes when he's talking about the Pharisees and scribes, especially when we consider that he had Pharisees and scribes among his followers, Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, and in the book of Acts, we see that many Pharisees join his ranks, as well as many priests. So he couldn't have been talking about every single one. It was about stereotypes. Okay, now, these guys didn't care about accuracy or about hurt feelings or any of that, or even if it was true or not. The goal was to promote their philosophy at all cost and to damage the philosophy of everyone else by calling everything the other side did into question. Like I said, it was mostly scripted. There were things that one said about philosophical enemies, whether it was true or not. Of course, when Yeshua says things are true, I'm not even going there. Let me clarify that. Everyone knew the rules of the game. You know, like modern political pundits, only people truly poisoned by the Kool-Aid believe everything that these guys say about the other side. And I don't care which side it is. Polemic was just one facet of the endless series of debates between competing philosophies. Now, Epicurean disciple Colodes, and I don't know if I said his name right, called some rivals buffoons, charlatans, assassins, prostitutes, and nincompoops. Plutarch retaliated with the charge that the Epicureans had prostitutes in their community. I could go into a lot more examples, but after a while, you would begin to recognize a topos. And topos is a word which means a standardized treatment of a subject. As I said before, it just means that there was a general script of insults and accusations that commonly came up in the arguments between rival philosophies. For example, one of the most popular jibes was that rivals were lovers of glory, lovers of money, and lovers of pleasure. And some of that ought to sound very familiar to New Testament readers. Yeshua uses it, so does Paul. So what was the real purpose of rhetoric? Polemic, not rhetoric. Was it to tear other people apart? No. That's how it's used today among the uninitiated on social media. But that was never the true goal of polemic by those who wielded it best. Polemic is all about saying, I, my school, my teacher, my philosophy is the best. Don't listen to those other guys. In essence, if anyone other than God or his chosen emissaries say it, and by chosen emissaries, I mean people who are like sitting in the council of God and actually hearing from him, not just people who are irritated. If anyone other than God or his chosen emissaries say it's boastful and dead wrong. The Pharisees, Sadducees, scribes, and Essenes all did this in their public wrangling. However, everyone was amateurs compared to the Essenes. Oh my gosh. You want some vitriolic reading? Check out the Dead Sea Scrolls and look at how the Essenes pretty much damned everyone in the world to hell and beyond in their writings. Only they were good, true, elect, the sons of light, and everyone else could only aspire to be them. It's actually, some of it's pretty offensive, and they're talking not about unbelievers, but about other Jews, about every other Jew who isn't an Essene. But when it came out of Yeshua's mouth, it served two purposes. One, it marked him off as the only one true teacher, and this is what we see in polemic. All polemic does this. Two, he was provoking his own death. And yes, I can prove that from the text. That last one should sober everyone up who likes to go out insulting people every day and then go back to their social media wall complaining about being blocked, unfriended, or called on the carpet for behaving badly. Yeshua didn't do this until the time came to provoke his own death. We should be similarly as committed to the consequences of our own words. We should realize that what worked in the first century is not effective or understood in modern culture and is not perceived in the same way. Yeshua was exalting himself, yes, and rightly so. But exalting himself and his philosophy, quote unquote, remember, philosophy is a moral system. It's a way of life. It is the seeking of moral health by those who are morally ill. By exalting himself and his philosophy over and above everyone else is literally assigning them to a lesser and even a deviant standard. He is going to say a lot of things that are going to that would classify the Pharisees and scribes in the ancient world as deviants, as people who should be considered to be on the outside of society and not on the inside society. And this is despite him oftentimes siding with one group of Pharisees against another. Remember, nobody disagrees with anyone 100%. Yeshua observed a lot of oral traditions. You know, the Sabbath day walk and, or Sabbath day journey. And he did the barakah. He recited the blessing when he broke bread. You're not going to find that kind of stuff in the Torah. Those are traditions of the elders. But when they get to the point where they're using their traditions of the elders to subvert the Torah, then he takes issue with them. Now, he wasn't denouncing every single Pharisee and scribe. Remember what Professor Johnson said, polemic has nothing to do with specific actions, but typical ones. Any teacher of whom you disapprove can be called a sophist or a charlatan, for example. Now, Yeshua addressed typical behavior and beliefs for Pharisees and scribes, not the behavior of any single Pharisee or scribe. And so he could come against Hillel's ruling of any cause divorce and rebuke Pharisees in general when the school of Shammai didn't agree with that. And individual Hillelites, maybe they would never think of divorcing their wife for frivolous reasons. And we talked about that a few weeks ago in the Teaching Eunuchs of the Kingdom, which can be found on my podcast channel. Now, polemic was based, it was all about generalization. And in verse 12, we're going to see, of chapter Matthew 23, we're going to see that Yeshua knew exactly what he was doing and what the consequences would be. So, the next thing we're going to do here when we come back after the break is we're going to read Matthew 23, all of it, because I want you to see the form of the polemic. And then I'm going to talk about some of the polemic writings of Josephus, Philo, and the Essenes for similarities. They are all Jews. They all were around during the first century. And so they were all products of this Hellenized Judaism. Remember that Judaism is still Hellenized. Remember the purpose of polemic was denouncing rival teachers, rival schools of thought, rival philosophies, and establishing one's own philosophical school as the only legitimate one. And, as Josephus might say, you can add Messianism, Yeshua's school of thought, to the list of philosophical schools. And Josephus does mention Yeshua, even though the text has been added to and corrupted. And we know that now because of the Arabic Josephus has been found. So some stuff was added, but Yeshua was originally in there. So we can add Messianism to the list of philosophical schools within Judaism. Again, philosophy meaning a moral system and way of life in Hellenistic times and kind of free from all the nonsense that we see in philosophy nowadays. Not all philosophy is ridiculous, but some absolutely is. And it's really remarkable. It's really remarkable. And like I said before, what we would call denominations, Josephus and Yeshua and everyone of the first century, they would call what we call denominations, they would call different philosophies within Christianity. So Baptists, Protestant or Catholics, whatever, they would be called philosophy. these. And they had a lot of them during the first century. All right, we'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to Character in Context. I'm Tyler Dawn Rosenquist, and we've been talking about the seven woes of Matthew 23, and I discussed what polemic is in the ancient world, Hellenistic insults, and the general literary form, and how it was simply how rival philosophical schools really denounced each other, debated each other, vied for supremacy. And so that's exactly what's happening here. So we're going to read Matthew 23 now that we've discussed all the stuff about polemic. And I'm going to show you how it fits the form and would have been an expected sort of interaction in those times. Of course, it doesn't mean the same thing now. And if we do it, we just look like jerks. But everyone in the audience understood what was going on. So then Yeshua, and I'm going to read from the Tree of Life version. It's a Messianic version from Messianic Jews. It's a really, really good, and all my friends are using it now. It's a very good translation. Then Yeshua spoke to the crowds and to his disciples, saying, "The Torah scholars and the Pharisees sit on the seat of Moses. So whatever they tell you, do and observe, but don't do what they do. For what they say, they do not do. They tie up heavy loads, hard to carry, lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves aren't willing to lift a finger to move them. All their works they do to be noticed by men. They make their tefillin long and their tzitzit long, or tefillin wide and their tzitzit long. They love the place of honor at feasts, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called rabbi by men. But you are not to be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. And call no man on earth your father, for one is your father who is in heaven. Nor are you to be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Messiah. But the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted." Now, I told you that I could prove from the text that he knew exactly what he was doing. Okay? One, he just said, one is your teacher, the Messiah, and here he's been sitting teaching them, and he is promoting himself as the only legitimate teacher right now. The legitimate founder of the only legitimate ultimate philosophical school. Make no mistake, this is what he is doing. This is a showdown. He is saying that everyone else is a distant second, or in the case of the Sadducees, like 100th place, because those guys were messed up. But then he says, the greatest among you shall be your servant. We've talked about that before. We talked about that in the crucifixion program. The greatest among you shall be your servant. That's him right there. He served the world on the cross. And he's going to at this point. But then he says, whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. He is also talking about himself here. Now, I realize this may be controversial, but make no mistake, he is exalting himself. Rightfully so. Okay? It's not like the king is really exalting himself when he says he's the king. But when you're this guy from Galilee, from Nazareth, yeah, and he claims to fame among the Jerusalem elites, even with all the miracles he worked, even with all of everything, he is an interloper. And he's coming out of Galilee with a crowd heralding him as the Messiah. And he is exalting himself by what he's about to do and by the fact that he just called himself the Messiah by promoting himself as the teacher that everyone should be listening to, and by denouncing through polemic the Pharisees, who had already set themselves up as his rivals. They had done that. He didn't have to say that he was their rival. They've been doing this all along, ever since the beginning of his public ministry started to attract enough attention. darn it, thing clicked up on my thing. I lost my train of thought. You know, ever since he attracted enough attention that they felt like he was a potential Messiah, that he was a threat, that sort of thing. But he says, whoever exalts himself shall be humbled. And he's exalting himself. What's about to happen? He's about to be humbled on the cross. All right? He knows what he is doing, and he knows what's going to happen because of it. He is broadcasting that none of this will be a surprise. But he also says, whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. Now, Paul said, and I can't remember where he said this. I think it was in Ephesians. I mentioned this in the crucifixion teaching, too, that he humbled himself even to the point of death on a cross. He humbled himself as a servant. And we see this throughout the scripture, that although Yeshua is exalting himself, he also humbles himself to the point where he is willing to die for even those who crucified him. And that is just remarkable. That's why he gets to exalt himself, okay? But even when he exalts himself, there was a price to be paid. He was instigating a showdown. This wasn't going to end well. All right. But woe to you, Torah scholars and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut people out of the kingdom of heaven, for you do not enter yourselves, nor do you let those enter who are trying to go in. Woe to you, Torah scholars and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel over land and sea to make one convert. And when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourself. Actually, it says Gehenna here. Woe to you, blind guides. You say, whoever swears by the temple, it's nothing. But whoever swears by the gold at the temple, he's obliged. Oh, fools and blind ones, which is greater, the gold or the temple that made the gold holy? And you say, whoever swears by the altar, it's nothing. But whoever swears by the offering on it is obligated. Oh, blind ones, which is greater, the offering on the altar or the altar that makes the offering holy? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears both by the altar and everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. Woe to you, Torah scholars and Pharisees, hypocrites! You tithe mint and dill and cumin, yet you have neglected the weightier matters of Torah, justice and mercy and faithfulness. It is necessary to do these things without neglecting the others. O blind guides, straining out a gnat while swallowing a camel. Woe to you, Torah scholars and Pharisees, hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and uncontrolled desire. O blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, so that the outside may become clean as well. Woe to you, Torah scholars and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but inside are full of dead man's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, you appear righteous to men on the outside, but are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, Torah scholars and Pharisees, hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the monuments of Tzadikim, that means the righteous ones in Hebrew. And you say, if we'd been alive in the days of our forefathers, we wouldn't have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your fathers. O snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the condemnation of Gehenna? Because of this, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and Torah scholars. Some of them you will kill and execute at the stake, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city. And so upon you shall come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Amen, I tell you, all these things will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those sent to her, how often I long to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will never see me again until you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Kind of hard to make that anything to be anything but polemic. Intra-Jewish polemic, of which we see a lot of in the writings of the Essenes, and others, but there's no way you can pretty that up. However, knowing that this was the accepted and recognized cultural form of exalting one school of thought over all others, it now makes more sense. It makes more sense as to the fact that Yeshua was saying, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. I mean, he wasn't just, those weren't small sayings. This was saying, I am the teacher. I am the Messiah. I am the one. I am your only teacher. Not that you can't have other teachers teaching about Messiah, obviously, or I'm out of a job here. But he is the teacher. He is the leader of the only legitimate, only totally legitimate school of philosophy, quote unquote, in the world. That's what he's saying here. He's labeling everyone else as deviants, as people who are suspect, as people who shouldn't be followed blindly, as people who, although they say something's right, sometimes they don't do what they say. Sometimes what they say is dead wrong. And like they said to honor your parents, but then they say, well, you can get out of that by declaring what you have korban, dedicated to God, and then, oh, you don't have to help your parents anymore, you can just let them starve. That's oppressing. Excuse me. They said, they talk about the sanctity of marriage, but then Hillel said, you can divorce your wife for anything that you find objectionable in her, even if she burns a meal. Akiva said, if you find someone prettier. Well, it's kind of, yeesh. The older I get and the more wrinkles I get and age spots, I kind of go, yeah, just about everyone's prettier than me nowadays. Now, fortunately, my husband does not ascribe to the ruling of the school of Hillel because he's still around, but and sometimes I even occasionally burn his meal because I can't be trusted with the broiler. It's just really sad. But this polemic launched at the Pharisees and scribes and in other parables, he goes against the Sadducees, even worse. Okay, but he does that in more of an allegorical parable way so that it's not, he can't be accused of actually insulting the high priest, which was a sin. And, he didn't do those kind of things. That's good. But he is saying that every school of thought except for his is illegitimate. There's just no other way to look at it because he was using polemic. He was exalting himself. He was denouncing them as deviants. He was really criticizing, and we're going to talk in upcoming weeks about each of the sections and what he was really saying. What did it mean to be a whitewashed tomb? And we find the answers to that in the Mishnah. And, what did it, we're going to talk about it, and I'm not going to go into this anymore here. But it was polemic. And actually, when we look at the rest of the polemic in the ancient world, he was actually very polite. Because this always bothered me. I would always read this, I'm going, dang, Yeshua, Lord, you say to be meek and humble and peaceable, and you do this. But the more I read this, and the more I studied it in the different commentaries, the more I started putting two and two together. And then I noticed last night in the middle of the night, I was praying about this, and the whoever exalts himself shall be humble, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. He was broadcasting everything. He was broadcasting his motivations. This is what he came to do. He came to die. And so he had to provoke a confrontation. And polemic was the way to do it. Doesn't mean that what he was saying wasn't true. In general, remember, polemic is generally true. It doesn't apply to every specific person. It doesn't have to. It's denouncing a school of thought and those who follow it, not denouncing the behavior of specific people. Didn't have to. So I told you we were going to look at some of some Jewish polemic, and we're going to look at some from Josephus. Oh, to put Yeshua's more polite polemic actually into context. Let's see, in Against Appian. Appian is not a Jew. Appian is a pagan who Josephus is attacking because Appian came against the Jews in a really big way. And so Josephus accuses him of malicious slander, which benefits his mendacious character. And all these quotes I'm taking from the Johnson article, which I really recommend you checking out. He is a low charlatan to the end of his days, a charlatan whose life is as dissolute as his language. He's ignorant. An ignorant fool, stupid. His mind is blinded. In fact, everything he charges the Jews with, he and his countrymen do themselves. In sum, Appian and other slanderers of the Jews are reprobate sophists and deceivers of youth and crazy fools. Philo is seen as a kind of a serene, kind of apologist guy. But even when he's going against Gentile anti-Semites, he has some... Oh, boy. Let's see. He talks about the Alexandrians and their hatred for Jews. Alexandria was in Egypt. It was a huge center of Judaism. He called them promiscuous and unstable rabble, and that they were more brutal and savage than fierce wild beasts. They had shameless designs. Alexandrians are adepts at flattery and imposture and hypocrisy, ready enough with fawning words, but causing universal disaster with their loose and unbridled lips. Let's see. Philo. Okay. It's like, it's all he can stand, he can't stand no more. Oh, here we go. Jeez, this is horrible. He says, for whether they kill their children in their initiations, or celebrate secret mysteries, or hold revels with strange customs, they no longer keep themselves or their marriage pure, but they either treacherously kill each other, or grieve one another by adultery, and all is a raging riot of blood and murder, theft and deceit, corruption, faithlessness, tumult, perjury, confusion over what is good, forgetful of favors, pollution of souls, sex perversion, disorder in marriage, adultery and debauchery. For the worship of idols not to be named is the beginning and cause and end of every evil. For their worshippers either rave in exultation or prophesy lies or live unrighteously or readily commit perjury. Whew. Okay, but if we want to know how Jews talk about each other, that was Jews talking about Gentiles who were saying just as bad stuff about them. I just didn't read that stuff. So... how did Jews talk about each other when they disagreed? Let's see. Josephus talks about Justice of Tiberius, and he calls him a charlatan and a demagogue and a deceiver. Let's see. He was full of knavish tricks, fraudulent practice, and impudence. Let's see. It's in the Jewish War, Josephus talks about the zealots and the Sicarii, who he blames for the destruction of the temple, which is true. They are to blame. He calls Judas the Galilean a sophist. He says every dictative religion is ridiculed by these men who scoffed at the prophet's oracles, as of religion is ridiculed by this man who scoffed at the prophets' oracles as impostors' fables. Their behavior brought these prophecies to fulfillment. What have you done that is blessed by the lawgiver? What deed has he cursed? What deed that he has cursed have you left undone? So really, he's accusing them of breaking every law that God set up. And the Sicarii, who were assassins and deserved, you know, anything that was said about them... they're imposters and brigands, slaves, dregs of society, and the bastard scum of the nation. They are more wicked than Sodom, for producing a generation more godless than the victims of those visitations, seeing that these men's frenzy involved the whole people in their ruin. He accused the Sicarii of cruelty, avarice, another word for greed, atrocities, lying, oppression, and evil. They outdo each other in acts of impiety toward God and injustice to their neighbors, oppressing the masses, bent on tyranny, violence, plundering, lawlessness, and cruelty. Yeah. This was Jews against Jews. Okay? Or this was Jew against Jews. Yeah. Funny thing, we don't find really any polemic against Samaritans, which is strange because they hated them. There's a little bit, but not until you're getting to the Mishnah. Let's see. I want to get to the Essenes before we sign off here. Oh, here we go. The Essenes, they had an extreme hostility to all outsiders. They called themselves the Sons of Light, and everyone else was the Sons of Darkness. I like what Johnson says here. The Qumran of rule of thumb is that you cannot say enough bad things about outsiders. They are sons of the pit, who derive from a spirit of falsehood and are ruled by the Angel of Darkness. That's from 1QS. And naturally, they all walk in the way of wickedness. God hates them and has vengeance planned for them. This is how the community rule, which is 1QS, that's the Dead Sea Scroll designation. This is talking about other Jews. Greed and slackness in the search of righteousness, wicked and lies, haughtiness and pride, falseness and deceit, cruelty and abundant evil, ill temper and much folly and brazen insolence, abominable deeds committed in a spirit of lust, and ways of lewdness in the service of uncleanness, a blaspheming tongue, blindness of eye, and dullness of ear, stiffness of neck, and heaviness of heart, so that a man walks in all the ways of darkness and guile. Jeez Louise! One of the rituals in the sect of the sect actually involved shouting curses against such men of the lot of Satan. They did this as part of their rituals. Be cursed, all your guilty wickedness. May he deliver you up to torture at the hands of all the wreakers of vengeance. Be cursed without mercy because of the darkness of your deeds. Be damned in the shadowy place of everlasting fire. May God not heed you when you call upon him, nor pardon you by blotting out your sin. May he raise his angry face towards you for vengeance. May there be no peace in you, for you in the mouths of those who hold fast to the fathers. Whew. This was not directed at the Romans. This was directed at other Jews who disagreed with the Qumran sect's ideas of purity. I mean, you know, you read that and all of a sudden it's kind of like Yeshua's polemic against the Pharisees looks really relatively tame in comparison. It's like, okay, as offensive as Yeshua's words, as much as they might bother us that he's really calling people on the carpet here, or as much as we might want to use it as license to be as down and dirty as we want, we can do neither of these things with this passage, because he was restrained in his rebuke. We can see that from other inter-Jewish polemic. He was restrained. He wasn't taking the cheap shots that a lot of these guys. As a matter of fact, he was backing everything he set up with actual examples, which was not characteristic of your general rhetoric. He was also not vilifying absolutely everyone. He was calling them on the carpet for the final final affront against God, which was the rejection of his final emissary. Yeshua was the last word. He was, you know, he's the son. He is the royal messenger. He is the one to whom, you know, he is the one that Moses preached about. He's the one that all the prophets preached about. The one they were told they had to listen to and they didn't. And so in the end, he had to denounce them and he had to prophesied destruction. He had declared destruction on that generation and the temple. And that's just the way it is. Anyway, we'll see you next week for the rest of, for more of the woes. Bye-bye now.